Campus FM presents a talk entitled The Book of Hours. The talk is organised by the Malta Historical Society.
My talk is going to be about the portfolio of Nazarene drawings. It's a portfolio, or we could also refer to it as an album, which is made up of 80 pages. And there are no less than 172 drawings inside this portfolio. It was among the many items which notary Francesco Catania had donated, thus eventually forming the Wynyacour Collegiate Museum collection. Unfortunately, up to now, there is no documentary evidence as to how this portfolio of drawings originally reached notary Catania's hands. It could have been in his possession formally as a portfolio, therefore as a complete collection, or he could have purchased these drawings separately and then possibly put them together in this portfolio. Now, on the cover of this portfolio, there is an important label which is with this handwritten inscription, Serie di schizzi fatti da vari alunni dietro tema dato dal maestro signor G. Hisler. So this label also helps to place this portfolio of drawings in context. G. Hisler, therefore referring to Giuseppe Hisler, who was quite an important artist in the 19th century, Maltese artist, who, after quite a number of years in Rome, between 1814 and 1822, was determined to found the Nazarene School in Malta. Now, let's place this portfolio in context in a better way. During his years in Rome, he came in direct contact with Johann Friedrich Overbeck and also established quite a long friendship. Overbeck was responsible for the foundation of the Brotherhood of St. Luke, also known as the Lukasbund or Lukasbruder in German. I don't know if my pronunciation is correct. Also known as the Nazarene School of Artists. Their principal aim was to look back at the art of the old masters, basically pre-Renaissance and Renaissance masters, because the Nazarene artists believed that the contemporary art and the art which followed the Renaissance was vulgar and ostentatious, and therefore the aim was to revive a sense of Christian purity in their art. So their masters, their sources, were mainly German and Italian masters of the 14th and 15th and early 16th centuries. And as you can see from a few of these paintings by the Nazarene artists, they clearly are very retrospective in style. So, Johann Friedrich Overbeck befriended Giuseppe Hisler, and Giuseppe, together with his brother Vincenzo Hisler, founded the Nazarene school in Malta, obviously making sure to promote the same principles. And these are two of their major works. So that was just a brief introduction to place the portfolio of drawings in context. Now, this is an example of a page in the portfolio. As I said, basically, almost every page is made up of these drawings pasted on, and there isn't a particular sequence or a particular system. In most cases, it seems that the aim was to fit in, to cram in, as many drawings as possible. 80 pages and 172 drawings, I think, is self-explanatory. Now, as far as media are concerned, we've got examples of pencil drawings, quite a number of them are pencil drawings, but have been kind of further defined by means of pen, either brown or black ink. We also have examples of sepia washes, and as far as subject matter, in the majority of cases, we've got religious themes, basically biblical scenes or devotional themes, but we also come across, although in minority, a few mythological and possibly even allegorical themes, some more pen and washes. There are about two or three which appear more portrait-like, and we have a few that seem to be sketches or studies for a tombstone or a lapidary design. Now, as far as levels of competence are concerned, we also have a varied example here. Some are rather clumsy and weak in draftsmanship. Others are better. They show a certain spontaneity, a certain freshness. It's as though initial ideas have been immediately put to paper. And we have also quite a number of drawings which are of a higher level in competence. Of course, we have to remember the label that is pasted on the cover of this portfolio, which is that we have in this portfolio a collection of sketches that have been drawn by the students of Giuseppe Hisler. So this portfolio is important because it casts light on the very rigorous art training system that Giuseppe Hisler implemented. And in the case of this drawing, and there are other examples which you will be seeing, what we notice is that there is this strong emphasis on line. The idea is that the representation has to be very clean, it has to be very clear, the visual legibility of the work has to be very clear. And this is very much in keeping with the Nazarene spirit, where the work being represented had to appeal to the Christian spirit. So it was important that iconographically the work had to be very clear, without any bravura or virtuosità that, for example, in the Nazarene eyes, was distracting as far as, for instance, Baroque and Rococo art, which was considered to be despicable to Nazarene artists. And apart from this emphasis on line, we also notice that even in the shading, we have a system of hatching and cross-hatching. Therefore, wherever there is shading, when one takes a closer look, once again, it is based on a system of lines. Some more examples where, again, linear qualities are very dominant, and the drawings are made more pronounced by means of these outlines in brown or black ink. And these are a few more examples where you can appreciate how the the drawing abilities are quite remarkable. And in fact, some have showed this remarkable control of line. There is this extremely sensitive use of line. Lines are thickened or made bold according to the needs of the composition. And in fact, one could say that drawings such as these possibly reflect the heavy dependence on prints. Artists, even training in fine arts academies, it was normal that as part of their artistic formation, they would copy or adopt representation schemes from prints. And it's in all probability Giuseppe Hisler would have made use of this system to pass on the teachings of the Nazarene philosophy, and also as part and parcel of their training to refine and improve their drawing skills. What is interesting, here are some more examples of these very, very fine drawings. What is interesting is that in the case of these particular drawings, where the outline is very pronounced, they can be quite closely compared to, for example, the drawings of John Flaxman, who was an important neoclassical English artist, who, incidentally, was heavily relied on by the Nazarene artists for his illustrations of Hesiod, Aeschylus, and Dante. And in fact, this particular drawing in the middle, which is part and parcel of the collection of the portfolio drawings, represents Dante and Virgil on the boat to hell. What is rather interesting, an intriguing work, is this mythological work. It's a scene I have not managed to identify, but somehow it reminds me, or at least points towards the direction of, for instance, William Blake. Now, obviously, you might think that this is a bit of a stretched comparison, but, you know, this is something that can be further investigated upon. Plus, one has to keep in mind that William Blake was the more romantic artist, very expressionist, very emotional in his artistic representations, therefore quite apart from the Nazarene approach. As I said, it was important for them to retrospectively look at the works of the old German and Italian masters, who were also referred to as the primitives, in the sense that their art reflected what was believed to have been the chaste way of life that was being led, very different to the more corrupt kind of life in the 19th century. All this according to Nazarene artists. And it's interesting to see that the drawings in the portfolio are evidence of this dependence on the old masters. And obviously, the works of these old masters would have been available in the form of prints or possibly sketches and drawings made by Giuseppe Hisler himself during his experience in Rome. So, for instance, this betrothal of the Virgin comes close in its organization of its composition and iconographically to for instance, the betrothal of the Virgin by Raffaello. You were only seeing a detail. But we can also closely compare it to a print by Albrecht Dürer, who was also a German artist that they looked up to. The next few slides are just a few more examples of sketches, which again I have included to show this dependence on the old masters. What one can appreciate is that they are not necessarily Slavish copies, but they are kind of adaptations. They are references. But of course, they were, in a sense, the visual Bibles for the Nazarene artists. And of course, the Maltese Nazarene artists would also have been familiar with the works of the German Nazarene artists who had established themselves in Rome. As we can see, this work by Franz Pohr, who was one of the co-founders of the Brotherhood of St. Luke. And it's also interesting that in some cases we can compare some sketches to some finished paintings by Maltese Nazarene artists, such as the pair of slides you can see over here. As I said, there were a few examples which seem to point to designs for marble tombstones, and we have to remember that Giuseppe Hisler, when he had established his Nazarene school, his Nazarene train of thought in Malta, in a sense he became the dictator of artistic affairs in Malta in the 19th century, and added to his many responsibilities was his supervision and his control of marble tombstones. In fact, Giuseppe Hisler, as probably most of you are aware, is synonymous with the project at St. John's Co-Cathedral, and his intention mainly was to rearrange the marble tombstone floor in an effort to inject the Nazarene spirit in the ostentatious Baroque interior of St. John's. Lapidary design would have been very congenial with the Nazarene spirit because it would have been an opportunity to once again emphasize linear qualities. And in fact, you know, this symmetrical design for the composition, the rather dignified appearance of the angels, the monochromatic appearance. Here we're talking about grisaille in the case of the two examples on the right, the grisaille technique. We can quite safely compare it to actual marble tombstone designs. The two at the top are actually designs by Giuseppe Hisler. And at the bottom right, this is a design by one of the followers of Giuseppe Hisler. And if you, for example, look at the slide on the at the bottom right, we can somehow relate it to, for instance, the grisaille drawing that we see in the portfolio. The portfolio of drawings offers a problem in the sense that practically none of them can be identified, none of them can be attached to a name, except for two, which are these two. Beneath both of these drawings is a handwritten inscription in pencil. With regards to the top, we have Jus Callea Dip, and at the bottom, Es Mikallef Ideo. Here we have a better view of this handwritten inscription. Now again, one has to approach this particular situation, which is an exception with regards to the rest of the portfolio. One has to approach it in a skeptical manner. Are these two works actually by Giuseppe Callea and Salvatore Mikallef, or are these works by other artists in the Nazarene art studio who are referring to works by Giuseppe Calleja and Salvatore Micallef. Basically, Giuseppe Calleja was, you could say, the foremost devoted follower and student of Giuseppe Hisler, to the extent that Giuseppe Hisler had entrusted quite a number of commissions to Calleja. And these are two examples of Giuseppe Calleja's paintings. Salvatore Micallef is also another important follower and devotee of Giuseppe Hisler. This is an example of one of his works. Salvatore Micallef is also known as a restorer. He was involved in a number of restoration works. Of course, it's important to look at this portfolio in context, as I said at the beginning of this lecture, and it was interesting to find that when looking at other collections of drawings, some interesting bridges could be made between the portfolio at the Wynyacourt Collegiate Museum and other drawings. This is something that has to be further studied and investigated, but at least this is a starting point. You are looking at the Pietà that is attached to the name of Giuseppe Calleja, and as you can see, it is practically identical or almost identical to a drawing which comes from the album of sketches by Giuseppe Calleja, coming from a private collection. And these two drawings seem to have been either preliminary sketches for or studies after this oil on canvas painting of the same theme from a private collection. So at least one drawing is put in a wider context. As I said, the importance of looking at drawings from other collections proves to be very valid, because it continues to cast more light on Giuseppe Hisler's art school system, and we get to know far more about the drawings in the portfolio. For instance, the sketch on the left comes from the portfolio in Rabat, and it was immediately paired with another drawing from the Giuseppe Calleja album. The two drawings on the left, which represent the Temptation of Saint Anthony from the portfolio once again, could be very, very easily compared with this pen and wash from the Fine Arts Reserve Collection. This is all I had to say about the portfolio. Basically, it deserves more study, and I hope that I will have the opportunity to carry out more studies on this portfolio. I thank you very much for your attention.
So, good evening. It's my turn now to talk to you a little bit about a book of ours, literally a book of ours, which survives at the Wynyacourt Collegiate Museum. And I'll take this opportunity to show you as much of this example as I possibly can. I know that Dun Juan has brought the actual book here, and therefore it will be available for viewing, but I'll try and, as I said, illustrate as many folios of this book as possible. Before actually starting my presentation, I'd like to thank a few people, apart from Dun Juan, for making this interesting book available for study. I'd like to thank my colleague, Teresa Zamitlupi, for taking the photographs of this book. I'd also like to thank Maroma Camilleri from the National Library in Valletta for also making accessible other works by Pigouchet, and for her colleagues too, for all their help and support. So, apart from showing as many folios of this particular example as possible, the presentation will take the following structure. I will provide a descriptive introduction to the publication, and this descriptive introduction will also relate the Pigouchet Book of Hours to other books of ours, in the sense that I will be showing, I will be illustrating this printed book in the light of what a standard book of hours is all about. I will give you an overview of its contents with particular reference to the little office of the Blessed Virgin, which is the central section, the most important section of a book of hours. Then, following that, I will give very brief comparative observations before I conclude on general characteristics presented. So, here we begin. The Wignacourt Collegiate Museum, Rabat, houses this early 16th century French printed and illuminated book of hours. It's interesting to note that this is both printed and illuminated. A number of us are probably familiar with books of hours such as the Très Richer, the Duc de Berry, which is a splendidly illuminated, hand-written, so manuscript, example. The books we are going to be looking at today belong to a transitional period. They belong to the period when printing was gained in popularity, and in the case of books of ours, which were very sought after books, we find that several examples were printed, but the people still wanted the general presentation of the manuscript version to be there. So hence we have a combination of techniques over here, okay? Print and illumination together. I add that the Book of Hours is a layman's devotional book. It is very strongly related to the breviary which a priest or a cleric would have owned. So the Book of Hours gave the lay person the opportunity to be devout in a similar way. And it incorporated a number of prayers which one would come across in a breviary. I could also add that this type of devotional book, the Book of Hours, gained in popularity, especially during the 15th century. And it was customary for any middle-class family to own a Book of Hours. And the Book of Hours was possibly the only book that particular family would have ever owned. But just like nowadays you need to own a DVD player or an MP3 player, in those days you had to own a Book of Hours to acquire a certain status. Also, interestingly, the Book of Hours was the book from which most people learned how to read. So it served not only to provide a sense of status to the family in terms of ownership, but it also had a function to teach people how to read, and also the function to pray. The provenance of this book remains unknown, though we know that it was discovered some 20 to 25 years ago by Dunjuan in the parish of St. Paul, Rabat. So we still have to conduct research in this area. Its presentation shows that it is characteristic of late 15th, early 16th century Parisian production of printed books of hours. And it was produced by a joint production by Philippe Pigouchet, who was a printer and publisher, and Simon Vautre, who was a publisher. And the two seem to have collaborated very closely on a number of similar projects. And this sort of exercise was also undertaken by two collaborators before their time. So it was something which was pretty common. So, just like the Bebe's portfolio is a portfolio of drawings, here we have sometimes of images which might not necessarily be very closely related to each other, and that these drawings are presented on, we have quite an array of drawings on single folios. Similarly, over here, in this example, we have several woodcuts this time, presented on the various pages which make up this book. The book consists of 122 folios, which means you've got to multiply that by 2 to figure out the number of pages. Okay, it's a pretty small book. It measures some 21 by 13 centimeters, so we're looking at something which is around this size, and that is the normal size for a book of hours. A book of hours was intended for private devotion, and therefore the size would normally be small. So if we're looking at, I mentioned earlier on, the Tre Richard, the Duc de Berry, which are enormous, those would not be the normal presentation of a book of hours. But since we are looking in that case at a patron of a certain level and who wanted to show off his wealth and also want to display his passion for books, then we have an out of the ordinary presentation in that case. Here we have a pretty normal format. The book shows us that it is made of parchment folios, so even though printing at the time was also on paper, we still have a retention of the parchment one comes across in the manuscript versions. It's printed in black ink, and we see finely ruled faint red ink. We see that it is finely ruled in faint red ink. In this case, you can't really see, but you have what are called ruling marks executed in faint red ink. And this is, once again, part of the standard presentation of the manuscript version. So we have this lingering element. What you're seeing here is folio 9 recto, which shows us, which gives us an idea of how the pages are decorated. You can see as well the type of type that is used. It's a Gothic type, which once again is very similar to Gothic script. So the presentation still as well gives you this feel of the manuscript version, organized on 27 lines of type to the page. And the text is in Latin, French, and English. And this is normal for a French publication of a book of hours of the use of sarum. I'll be talking about this later on. But it's interesting to take a look, for example, at the English insertions. When thou goest first out of thy house, bless thee, saying thus. And there's a prayer that follows, and there are a number of similar entries. Signatures are marked with an S to indicate the use of sarum for easy reference in the collating and binding process. Signatures are basically gatherings or choirs. When a book is made, there are a number of folios which together form a unit of production, so to say. And these normally consist of 8 folios together, and together they form a signature. Okay, if you look at the spine of a well-produced book nowadays, you see that there are sort of like groupings. Those are called signatures. So each signature, not necessarily each actually, a number of signatures are marked with this S, indicating sarum, and also the number of the signature, and in this case we can also see the particular folio number. Anyway, this is to facilitate collation. But it's interesting to note that there was the necessity to include these details because it is a sign of how busy Pigouchet and Vautre were. They were so busy that they would have had a number of different books of hours being produced at the same time, and so as not to get these confused, they had to include these indications. The use of Sarum refers to the liturgy originating in Salisbury. Just a little background about uses. It's known that there were regional differences in the Christian liturgy, particularly in relation to the divine office on which books of hours, especially the little offices of the Blessed Virgin, are dependent. And so for this cycle of daily prayers to be recited at the eight canonical hours of the day, we do come across these variants, depending on these regional differences that I've mentioned. Later on, I'll be referring to the use of Rome, which was a very common use, and also the use of Lisieux. There were several other different types of uses, so for now it's just useful to know that they existed and that there are these slight differences. They don't really affect the pictorial presentation of the book, but it's more the actual differences, subtle differences in the prayers that would be included in the book. These regional differences were later abolished during the reforms of the Council of Trent, when everything became harmonized. Now, what strikes us about this book and books produced by Pigouchet are the borders which surround each and every page of the book. So each, probably by now you've already started getting used to the general presentation of within this book. Here we can see the border as it features in folio 35 recto, which shows fine decoration using philomorphic motifs, the inclusion of inhabited panels and also historiated panels. So we have the inclusion of purely vegetable motifs. You have also the inclusion of panels which can't be identified, in the sense that panels that feature figures which cannot be identified and therefore they are inhabited. And you also have the inclusion of historiated panels, therefore panels in which a story is being told and can be identified. The subject matter is varied. There are sacred subjects, genre scenes, together with representations of the Sibyls, and you can see a Sibyl right up there, and another one beneath, and their location is standard throughout the book. These are in a late Gothic style, and together form full borders, therefore borders that surround the complete text. We can refer to these as woodcut vignettes, and they are executed in a particular technique, the manier criblée, woodcut technique, which is particularly noticeable down here. These panels within the borders, these border panels, are also complemented by 20 large woodcut illustrations. And these are stylistically similar, so the woodcut illustrations are similar to the vignettes that mark important sections of the book. I'll talk a little bit about this and proceed to the next point. When looking at an illuminated manuscript, you notice that the decoration that it contains serves a number of purposes. One of the purposes is to embellish the book itself, to make it more pleasing to the eye. Another could be to translate into a visual language that which is present in the text. However, I think one of the most important functions of these images is to help the beholder find his way around the book. we are looking at, we are talking about books that don't have tables of contents, okay, or indices, but books that can use the image as what I call bookmarks. So if I notice that there's a particular image, I can assume that the text that follows that image is a particular text. And we'll be noticing this when we'll be looking at a number of examples. I'm not going to be illustrating all the examples, but you do get a feel of what text follows thanks to the images that are included. And this also relates to what is referred to as the hierarchy of decoration. There is a certain order in which decoration is presented. Naturally, I've included over here reference to 20 large woodcut images, okay? And these 20 large woodcut images mark the beginning of important sections of text. So where I see those large woodcut images, I say, ah, okay, this is a main text, a main section. There are other smaller woodcut images, such as the example you can see over here, which show subsections. And these form part of the hierarchy. So what I refer to over here is, in fact, a small woodcut interpolation of the text. Together with these large woodcuts and smaller woodcuts, we also find hand-painted, illuminated, infilled initials. You can see a number of examples here. You can see that the chromatic scheme is very, very simple. All we have is the use of red, blue, black, white, and gold. That is all. There's nothing particularly exciting about the palette that is used. However, they definitely add certain brightness to the page, and once again remind us that these books had a manuscript past. So these illuminations are included, they are hand-painted on a printed book. Naturally, if you come across a large illuminated initial or larger illuminated initial, then that text is more important than that. So this is part of the hierarchy I was mentioning earlier on. The title page of this book provides the beholder with useful information. What does it tell us? Apart from presenting us the device of Philippe Pigouchet, which was the first illustration I showed you, it includes a Latin text that states that these Hours of Sorrow were printed in Paris by Philippe Pigouchet for the publisher Simon Vautre. And we actually also have a date, which actually took Dunjuan and I quite a long time to figure out. But after, a bit of logic, we actually managed to get there. So we have a date to this book, which is 20th October 1501. Now, very, very quickly, I'm going to go through the elements of the Book of Hours, and you're going to be seeing that the woodcuts, the large woodcuts I mentioned, are going to be preceding important bits of text. One of the important elements of a Book of Hours, of any Book of Hours, is the calendar. And here you can see the inclusion of Astrological Man just before the calendar section. This is the month of February, just because today we're in February. After the calendar and some prayers, we come across what are called gospel sequences, which feature excerpts from the gospels. And these are then followed by the Passion according to John. And here, this is headed by a woodcut of the kiss of Judas. So, as I said earlier on, each important bit of text features that sort of large woodcut. But the most important text is the Little Office of the Blessed Virgin. It is, in fact, people refer to the Hours of the Blessed Virgin. When we talk about books of hours, we refer to the Hours of the Blessed Virgin. And as I said, the most important text within any Book of Vows is in fact this little office. Here it is preceded by a representation of the Tree of Jesse, and interestingly, alongside the little office of the Blessed Virgin, are the short offices of the cross. These are inserted alongside the offices of the Virgin. And normally the short offices of the cross are presented as a separate text, but in this case they're accompanying. And I've come across other printed examples which display this association. I mentioned that the little office of the Blessed Virgin is the most important text within every book of ours. So the relative importance of this section is highlighted by the presence of many more woodcuts, and many more woodcuts of a large scale. So it is here that the beholder is presented with a concentration of embellishment. The Pigouche, the Winiaku Pigouche, therefore is no exception to the standard. Okay, every book of ours would have such a concentration of embellishment. And here we see an annunciation scene which typically heads matins. The eight canonical hours feature particular representations, and these representations are largely standard. So if you are leafing through a book of hours, normally you would find an annunciation preceding matins. Okay? There are other large woodcuts which precede the prayers to be recited at the remaining canonical hours, so that for Lourdes we have the visitation scene, for Prime we have the Nativity, for Terce we have this adoration of the shepherds, we have the adoration of the Magi in Sext, for Nones we have this presentation in the temple, Vespers the flight into Egypt, and finally Compline we have the Domitian scene. These are largely, as I said, standard scenes which accompany the eight canonical hours within the little office of the Blessed Virgin. So our Pigouche example follows a pattern that had been developed over a number of years in the manuscript form. After the little office of the Virgin come several prayers in Latin and English, until the beginning of the seven penitential psalms appear. This element is characteristically accompanied by representations of the death of Uriah and David watching Bathsheba in her bath. And here you have the two images represented. So this is, you can see how splendid a two-page spread this is. Other elements of the Book of Hours are the 15 gradual psalms, the litany, and the suffrages. And here you can see a two-page spread of the litany. And this is one of the telltales. So if I did not have my S of Sarum at the beginning of every gathering, or if I didn't have a reference to the use of Sarum in my title page, I would probably have managed to figure out that this was the use of Sarum through the litany. There are other methods of finding out what the use is, but this is one of the easiest. And here you can see that there are several references to saints from the British Isles. I don't know if you can actually see, but all the Winifreds and Dunstans and Cuthberts are included in this list of saints. And the order in which these saints is presented is also an indication of the provenance of the book, as in for where it was intended, rather than, okay, because we know it was made in Paris. The Pigouche and Votre were particularly renowned for their borders surrounding the text of the Office of the Dead, which follows the suffrages. And here you can see one particular border. The borders depict the danse macabre and act as a reminder that death, which we know was a strong preoccupation within medieval society, comes for all, irrespective of status. So whether you are Pope and you have a representation of a Pope in the top-ish left-hand corner, whether you're a Pope, a blacksmith, an abbess, or whatever, death, you were going bound to die. And there are very vivid representations of these different scenes, all accompanied by symbols, a strong symbolic content linked to death. The Wignacourt Book of Hours, also includes a series of prayers at the end of the book, the more important prayers preceded by small woodcuts that relate to the respective text. So here we have the prayer of the Mater Dolorosa, Stabat Mater Dolorosa, and included alongside that prayer is the crucifixion scene. Very, very quickly, I'd like to highlight the fact that the Wignacourt Book of Hours is not the only devotional book surviving in Malta, which was the fruit of this collaboration between Pigouche and Votre. The National Library in Valletta, the Biblioteca in Valletta, in fact, houses two interesting books of ours that the two of them produced. The finer example is an Incunabulum, which dates to 1497, and it is the example which bears the closer relationship with the Wignacourt example. The other is comes from the Rare Book Collection and was produced in or shortly after 1502. So you can see that they are really close contemporaries. The 1502 or later example remained unfinished, and it's really interesting because it shows us how these examples were actually made. So whilst seeing a few illustrations, I'll be pointing out certain characteristics. So we will be seeing what the product would have looked at had it not received illumination, which in this case it actually did not receive. So what I'm going to be doing is showing you some images which illustrate the relationship between these hours of the use of Sarum, Rome and Lisieux respectively. So Sarum is our Wignacourt example, Rome is our Incunabulum, and Lisieux is the unfinished rare book. So this is the title page of the Wignacourt example. That's the title page of the example, the Incunabulum. And this is the title page of the 1502 or later example. You can see that for the Rome, the use of Rome example, we have similar woodcuts recycled, okay, actually the same woodcuts recycled, the device of Philippe Pigouche, and also the marginal decoration, which is similar in presentation. But the Incunabulum is richer in embellishment. You can see that you have the inclusion of red and gold to further accentuate the border. The third example presents a totally different device, not that of Pigouche, but that of Votre. Astrological man, as presented in the Wignacourt example, similar presentation in the Incunabulum, but a different woodcut used for the latest of the three examples. It's we'll look at some other examples now. This comes from the little office of the Blessed Virgin within the Wignacourt example. The same section within the Incunabulum, and representation of the Nativity from the 1502 or later example, which shows another interesting point. Here we can clearly see another element of transition. We've referred to the transition between manuscript and printed, the printed form. In this woodcut, we can see the transition from a Nordic to an Italianate style, a style which is dependent on Dürer's production, which is known to have influenced French, Parisian production of this time. You might tell me that the third example bears no relationships whatsoever to the earlier two, but in this Adoration of the Magi, you can see that the same woodcut was used. So yes, there still is a relationship between these examples. Interestingly, over here you can see the place that would have received illumination as it did in the Incunabulum. So there I have a missing D of Deus. The Domitian scenes, once again, we have the inclusion of a Renaissance-style Domitian scene for the later of the examples. And here I conclude. So, the Winyaku Book of Hours of the Use of Sarum is definitely an important work that is representative of early 16th century Parisian printed Book of Hours, Books of Hours. Together with the Hours of the National Library of different uses, the use of Rome and Lisieux, it is a fine example of how such early printed Books of Hours emulated manuscript, the manuscript versions that came before. The three examples, which are, as I said, near contemporaries, are also important, as illustrated, for their the evidence that they provide of this transition from late Gothic to the Italianate Renaissance style. So I will stop here. I've given you a little bit of a taste of this treasure that exists at the Winyaku Museum, and I thank you too for your attention.
I shall be talking about 12 different printed published works that exist in the Winyakurt Museum, the library as such, the library section of the museum. I would like to say something before I actually start about how I came to know about this library. In fact, I was preparing a study which is being published right now in Treasures of Malt. Actually, the first part has come out, the second part will come out in Easter, about British authored publications, or else publications in English that were available in Malta, present in Malta, during the period of the Knights of St. John. And in such circumstances, I have discovered that it's always wise to consult someone like Don Juan over here. I told him, would you by any chance have something British authored or else in English in your library? He immediately told me, yes, we have something, you should come here and try to, whether you can discover something else that we don't even know about it ourselves. A couple of days later, in fact, I went there and I did find a couple of publications. I shall be referring to them in this talk, which are of very significant importance. They are not militancy items, but some quite rare editions of works that I would say many academic institutions abroad would only be too glad to have the material that we have here actually. I shall be starting with a number of militancy items, actually, that that are to be found in the Winyakurt book collection. And I have to start with this work. Okay, for most of you, this is might be familiar, but I mean I cannot exclude something like this. The first published, the first printed description of the Maltese Islands by Jean Quentin Dutton, published in Lyon way back in 1536. So basically we're talking the very first years of the order in Malta. We have this Frenchman, himself a member of the order, who writes and who gets published this short but fundamentally important description of the island, as it was practically when the knights arrived on the island. Besides its bibliographical worth, besides its importance as a book on its own right, it is a fundamentally important historical document because, of course, it describes Malta of the period, not just describes Malta of the period, but also relates legends that were tied up with the history of Malta. So you get this early 16th century overview, the island as it was, he describes, for example, the houses of the Maltese. He gets this comparison, they resemble African huts. So you get a very good picture of the situation in Malta at the very start of the rule of the order on the island. Of course, another fundamentally important part of this book is the engraved map of Malta that is featured in the publication. Again, we're talking about another first here. This is the earliest printed known map of the Maltese Islands. Okay, 1536. A rather primitive, a rather primitive rendering, geographical rendering of the island. Of course, one has to keep in mind the objective of the mapmaker in this case. The objective wasn't so much to depict a geographically accurate map of the island, even though they didn't have, of course, the actual technique, the actual apparatus to do such a thing. But what was most important was to depict the important areas of the island. Okay, you don't just get this in this map. You get this in many other maps of the period and even later on. So you get the emphasis on the harbour area, which of course was the most important area for the knights in Malta. You also get the fortified parts of the island. Okay, so you get Mdina, of course, much larger than it actually is. You also get the castle in Gozo. And you also get the flag of the order at Birgu. So really, a depiction of the crucial areas, the areas which are really important on Malta. An extremely rare publication in Malta. We know of three copies of this. We know of this copy at the Winiakurt Library. There's another copy of this in the Gozo Public Library and a further copy in a private collection. So we're talking about something extremely rare. Definitely one of the treasures of the Winiakurt Museum. In 1980, this book was translated in English by Dr. Ray Giovella, and there is this useful edition with the original Latin text accompanied by a translation in English. Some examples of Melitensia. I wanted to show some examples of the rarer sort of Melitensia, the type of books which very often are unknown in the sense that, in two senses actually, in the sense that, more often than not, they are not even available in the National Library of Malta. For me, that is, of course, that puts a book with any relation to Malta, into a particular significance. But also, Melitensia in the sense that, not necessarily about Malta in this case, but what you get in this book and in subsequent books, books which start to bear a dedication to individual grandmasters. And the content of the book might have absolutely nothing to do either with Malta or with the order. But to get these publications from the mid-17th century onwards, particularly, this is a rather early example, this is 1682, of books, publications, dedicated, for a variety of reasons, to the reigning grandmaster of the period. Again, what we have here, La Tutela Angelica, descritta dal padre Gregorio Carfora Napoletano, De Chierci Regolari Minori, etc., dedicata all'eminentissimo principe Fra Don Gregorio Carafa, Gran Maestro in Malta, printed in Naples, 1682. Again, I am not aware of any other copy of this book. It is not even mentioned in the standard bibliographies of the order. That's another thing. I referred to the lack of certain publications in the National Library. That is one thing that gives certain rarity to a publication. Another one is that you don't get a number of these publications mentioned in the standard bibliographies of the order. You start from the 18th century, Francesco Paolo da Smitmer, then Helvald, and you don't get these works mentioned there. An own book, actually, this is listed by Helvald. Copies are available in the National Library of Malta as well. But still, certainly a valuable publication, a publication worth noting that it's available here in the Winniaport Museum. Historia Panegirica e Morale del Glorioso San Giovanni Battista, of course, the patron saint of the order here, so the connection is more than obvious. Most probably a work commissioned by the order itself to have this history of their patron saint, by Francesco Antonio Poma da Trapani, etc. It's quite a hefty, about 300 plus, a large folio publication, dedicated to the reigning grandmaster. We're talking here 1714. Perellos died the year after 1714. He was already actually not in control of the order. He died the following year, dedicated to the Grand Master, printed in Rome, Stamperia, Rocco Bernabò, 1714. Of course, we have to keep in mind, we're in the 18th century here, we have to keep in mind that there were no printing facilities in Malta during this period. The history of printing in Malta is quite fascinating in its own right. You get a short period in the 17th century, roughly between 1642 and 1656, when you had printing facilities on the island. Printing was permanently suspended because of disputes on censorship rights between the Grand Master and the Inquisition. And for exactly 100 years, you don't get any printing activity on the island. Well, there might have been some printing of playing cards, for example, of very small items, but the printing of books was definitely out. We had to wait till 1756, until Grand Master Pinto finally obtained an agreement with the Holy See with regards to censorship rights on the island. So you will get nothing pre-1756 that was printed locally. And the order did have these connections, particularly with Italian printers, with renowned Italian printers. This is definitely one of the big ones in the 18th century, Rocco Bernabò, also in Naples, also in Sicily, where they had these works published there. These books from the Winniaport collection, as from many other collections, of course, are also interesting because of the notes they have, of manuscript notes, sometimes book plates as well. In this case, we actually have Santa Ecclesia Collegiale Sacra Crypta Santi Paoli Apostoli. More interesting than that, on the following page, you get an 18th century contemporary inscription in manuscript, Dono di sua eminenza 1714. Okay, so we get it there that the Grandmaster had donated. Another very interesting book, actually, Politica Civile e Militare, divisa in massime ed aforisme per istruzione dei principi, magistrati e militari, by Giuseppe Grillo. Basically, this work is a sort of political treatise, how a wise prince should rule, a sort of early 18th century Machiavelli, in a way. In fact, he does refer to Machiavelli as well. Printed in Messina, and dedicated this time to Grandmaster Villena, here in 1726. And you get this dedication to Grandmaster Villena. This book is interesting for a number of reasons. The content itself is interesting. How a ruler should gain and keep the respect of his subjects, for example. You get these chapters. Also, the fact that it has this engraving with the coat of arms of Grandmaster Villena. Another aspect is that in the archives of the order in Valletta, there is actually a letter from Grandmaster de Villena to the author, to Grillo, where the Grandmaster is thanking the author, first of all, for the dedication of the book to the Grandmaster, and also for the fact that the author had sent a box full of this work to the Grandmaster. Okay, so you get this connection, the correspondence of the... In fact, again, when you are doing research, you come across certain things, and then sort of, at first, you have a problem, but then it sort of solves out. I had first come across this letter by Grandmaster Villena and said, there's a publication here. He's referring to a publication by a certain Grillo. But the letter was dated 1727. So the next thing I did was I went to the catalogue of the National Library, I searched under Grillo, and I found the publication, so I said, okay, this must be it. This must be the work that Grandmaster Villena is referring to. When I got the book, I found out that the book in the National Library is dated 1733. So there's something strange there. It cannot be the same book, because de Villena wrote in 1727. When I came across this copy over here, then things, of course, made sense. So Grillo published another book, but these two that I'm talking about. He published this one in 1727, to which Villena's letter refers, and another book in 1733. Now, the 1733 book is available in the National Library. This one is not. So this one is available here. So this finding militancia, finding copies here, copies there, bibliographies that are still not adequate, still quite some work that needs to be done. Another work dedicated to the same Grandmaster Villena. Stanze d'Ippolita Cantelmi Stuart, who was a relation, of course, of the Stuart, of the English royal family, who were exiled, of course, to Italy. And she wrote, this is a book of poetry, actually, in lode dell'eminentissimo principe Antonio Manuel, Gran Maestro di Malta, again, printed in Naples, another quite active, quite important 18th century press in Naples, Felice Mosca, 1729. And you get a series of poems dedicated to Villena. I have yet to discover the relation between this Ippolita Cantelmi Stuart, Villena, but knowing Villena, it might be worth exploring a bit what was going on here, actually. quite a beautiful publication, even the designs used, decorated capitals. It's quite a beautiful, quite a beautiful work, actually, it is. I shall be passing now to strictly non-military items. Very often we tend to concentrate on militancia, but again, it's amazing the books that you come across in Malta. We have, I think now we are becoming more aware, we are becoming more conscious of the cultural value of these things, of books, publications, etc. There is a considerable amount of libraries, of small libraries, libraries pertaining to convents, to religious institutions, to private, semi-private establishment, very often, unfortunately, completely unknown, if not downright abandoned. It is always one of my greatest pleasures to go to one of these places. The dustier, the better, because it means that no one had been there for quite some years. And you never know what treasures you would come across in these places. This is a treasure, actually. Assertio Septem Sacramentorum Adversus Martin Lutherum Enrico Octavo Anglia Regia Auctore, the famous book by, or attributed to, Henry VIII, first edition, 1521, in which he rebutted Luther's attacks on a number of things, on the giving of indulgences. Definitely an important book. What we have here actually is an edition printed in Paris in 1562, of course, by which time Henry VIII had switched over to Protestantism. He had been dead for quite some years as well. Quite a later edition, okay? As I said, the first edition of this work was published in 1521, and the manuscript copy of it had been sent to Rome, to the Pope, where it's still preserved, and autographed by Henry VIII. The actual authorship of this book is still shrouded in controversy. Henry VIII might have been responsible, at least in part, for this book. However, there are also cases for Thomas More being author, at least in part, of this work. And also Bishop John Fisher of Rochester. In fact, this particular edition here bears the name of John Fisher, who was Bishop of Rochester. Autore, Ioanne Rossensi Episcopo, who was no one else but John Fisher of Rochester. Now, John Fisher had quite an eventful career. He was one of the favorites, one of the advisors of Henry VIII prior to the Reformation. Come the Reformation, John Fisher broke away with Henry VIII, and he started getting, he was arrested, started getting persecuted, until eventually by 1535, John Fisher ended up in the Tower of London. There's this story, I mean, it's hearsay or whatever, that at that point the Pope tried to save the life of John Fisher, and he decided to make him a cardinal, and so to send him the cardinal's hat to England. There's the story that upon hearing of this, Henry VIII got very angry, and he said, no, I will not accept the cardinal's hat to come to England, but I will send John Fisher's head to Rome. Mythologia Britannica, flowers. It's a description of flowering plants in England. In Latin, of course, as far as I could find out, this constituted the second published flora of the British Isles. Okay? Published in 1650, London, Richard Coates. Interesting as well, in Cimiterio Sancti Pauli. It was printed in the cemetery of St. Paul, of old St. Paul's, of course, of pre 1666 St. Paul's, the old Gothic St. Paul's, because around St. Paul's, the churchyard of St. Paul, you had all these publishers and printers there. It was a hive of printing activity round in the churchyard area of old St. Paul's. And this was one of the publishers who worked there. Another interesting feature of this book is it still features the imprimatur. Now, England was the first country, basically, to introduce freedom of the press. Okay, but here we're talking 1650, during the Protectorate, during the Commonwealth. Okay, Oliver Cromwell, just some years prior to the granting of liberty of the press. Right, so you still get basically what you continue to get in other European countries, down to the French Revolution and even in Malta throughout the 18th century, the imprimatur, okay, the permission by the relevant authorities that this book could be published. But here we are quite late in the day. Historia Plantarium, it's not English, it was published in Italy, in Milan. The book is in Latin. It's a huge publication. Very beautifully illustrated by a large number of engravings. It is also related to Malta because this other book features the fungus melitensis, that type of parasitic plant that grows in Il Jebla Tal General on Gozo. My personal opinion, I left one of the best for last. Isaac Newton's most important work, Philosophia Naturalis, Principia Mathematica, Auctores Acco Neutonio. Amazingly enough, no less than two copies of this edition are available in the Wynyacourt collection. When I saw them, in fact, I was quite more than impressed, actually. They are not first editions. The first edition was printed in London in 1687. Then you had two other editions printed in England, but this is the first edition of the Principia, and the Principia is, as I said, the most fundamental work by Newton. This is the first edition of the Principia, which was published outside Britain. Okay, it was published in Amsterdam in 1714. And when I was doing research on this edition, I found out that this was a pirated edition. That is, it was printed without the authorization of the author and of the publishers in England. In fact, you notice down there, you do not get the name of the printer or the name, or this was became common throughout the 18th century. Amstel Odami Sumptibus Societatis. And there you are. Okay, it was pirated by that time. This book had already assumed practically best-selling status. So you start getting these pirated editions of these works. Again, in this case, you get Sancti Pauli there, in old hand. That is, it indicates that this book had reached the Wynyacourt collection quite early on. And also in this copy, there is the name Salvatore Mifsud in old hand as well. Okay, it seems, again, 18th century hand. So it would be interesting, perhaps, one to try to trace who the Salvatore Mifsud was and what was his interest with such a publication. As far as I know, I mean, and I have to emphasize, as far as I know, this is the earliest edition of this work available in Malta. Okay, when I checked at the National Library, the earliest edition of the Principia is 17. There were a large number of editions following this. Okay, the earliest edition in the National Library is 1739. Here we're talking 1714, the first non-British edition. I'm going to stop there. Thanks very much for your attention.
You have just listened to a talk entitled The Book of Ours. The talk is organized by the Malta Historical Society.